Look it over, but return it. Then he said to Hiroko, See that I get it back, Miss Hiroko. Of a surety, it will be backhanded, respected sir. She nodded her head gravely. Trevise smiled and walked on. He was more comfortable without the jacket in the light, mild breeze. He had detected no visible weapons on the persons of any of those about him, and he found it interesting that no one seemed to show any fear or discomfort over Trevise's. They did not even show curiosity concerning them. It might well be that they were not aware of the objects as weapons at all. From what Trevise had so far seen, Alpha might well be a world utterly without violence. A woman, having moved rapidly forward so as to be a little ahead of Bliss, turned to examine her blouse minutely, then said, Hast thou breasts, respected madam? And, as though unable to wait for an answer, she placed her hand lightly on Bliss's chest. Bliss smiled and said, As thou hast discovered, I have. They are perhaps not as shapely as thine, but I hide them not for that reason. On my world, it is not fitting that they be uncovered. She whispered in an aside to Pellerat, How do you like the way I'm getting the hang of classical galactic? You did that very well, Bliss, said Pellerat. The dining room was a large one, with long tables to which were attached long benches on either side. Clearly, the Alphans ate community fashion. Trevise felt a pang of conscience. Bliss's request for privacy had reserved this space for 5 people and forced the Alphans generally to remain in exile outside. A number, however, placed themselves at a respectful distance from the windows, which were no more than gaps in the wall, unfilled even by screens, presumably so that they might watch the strangers eat. Involuntarily, he wondered what would happen if it were to rain. Surely the rain would come only when it was needed, light and mild, continuing without significant wind till enough had fallen. Moreover, it would always come at known times so that the Alphans would be ready for it, Trevise imagined. The window he was facing looked out to sea, and far out at the horizon, it seemed to Trevise that he could make out a bank of clouds, similar to those that so nearly filled the skies everywhere but over this little spot of Eden. There were advantages to weather control. Eventually, they were served by a young woman on tiptoeing feet. They were not asked for their choice, but were merely served. There was a small glass of milk, a larger of grape juice, a still larger of water. Each diner received 2 large poached eggs, with slivers of white cheese on the side. Each also had a large platter of broiled fish and small roasted potatoes resting on cool green lettuce leaves. Bliss looked with dismay at the quantity of food before her and was clearly at a loss where to begin. Phelim had no such trouble. She drank the grape juice thirstily and with clear evidence of approval, then chewed away at the fish and potatoes. She was about to use her fingers for the purpose, but Bliss held up a large spoon with tined ends that could serve as a fork as well, and Phelim accepted it. Pellerat smiled his satisfaction and cut into the eggs at once. Trevise said, Now to be reminded what real eggs taste like, followed suit. Hiroko, forgetting to eat her own breakfast in her delight at the manner in which the others ate, for even Bliss finally began with obvious relish, said at last, Is it well? It is well, said Trevise, his voice somewhat muffled. This island has no shortage of food, apparently, or do you serve us more than you should out of politeness? Hiroko listened with intent eyes, and seemed to grasp the meaning, for she said, No, no, respected sir. Our land is bountiful. our sea even more so. Our ducks give eggs, our goats both cheese and milk, and there are our grains. Above all, our sea is filled with countless varieties of fish in numberless quantity. The whole empire could eat at our tables and consume not the fish of our sea. Trevise smiled discreetly. Clearly, the young elfin had not the smallest idea of the true size of the galaxy. He said, "You call this island New Earth, Hiroko. Where, then, might Old Earth be?" She looked at him in bewilderment. "Old Earth, say you? I crave pardon, respected sir. I take not thy meaning." Trevise said, "Before there was a new earth, your people must have lived elsewhere. Where was this elsewhere from which they came?" "I know not of that, respected sir," she said with troubled gravity. "This land has been mine all of my life, and my mother's and grandmother's before me, and, I doubt not, their grandmother's and great-grandmother's before them. Of any other land I know not." "But," said Trevise, descending to gentle argumentation, "you speak of this land as New Earth. Why do you call it that?"
"Because, respected sir," she replied, equally gentle, "that is what it is called by all, since the mind of women goeth not to the contrary."
"But it is New Earth, and therefore a later earth. There must be an old earth, a former one for which it was named. Each morning there is a new day, and that implies that earlier there had existed an old day. Don't you see that this must be so?"
"Nay, respected sir, I know only what this land is called. I know of naught else, nor do I follow this reasoning of thine, which sounds very much like what we call here chop logic. I mean no offense."
And Trevise shook his head and felt defeated. 77. Trevise leaned toward Pellerat and whispered, "Wherever we go, whatever we do, we get no information." "We know where Earth is, so what does it matter?" said Pellerat, doing little more than move his lips. "I want to know something about it." "She's very young, scarcely a repository of information." Trevise thought about that, then nodded. "Right, Genoff." He turned to Hiroko and said, "Miss Hiroko, you haven't asked us why we are here in your land." Hiroko's eyes fell, and she said, "That would be but scant courtesy until you have all eaten and rested, respected sir."
"But we have eaten, or almost so, and we have recently rested, so I shall tell you why we are here. My friend, Dr. Pellerat, is a scholar on our world, a learned man. He is a mythologist. Do you know what that means?"
"Nay, respected sir, I do not."
"He studies old tales as they are told on different worlds. Old tales are known as myths or legends, and they interest Dr. Pellerat. Are there learned ones on New Earth who know the old tales of this world?"
Hiroko's forehead creased slightly into a frown of thought. She said,
"This is not a matter in which I am myself skilled. We have an old man in these parts who loves to talk of ancient days. Where he may have learned those things, I know not, and methinks he may have spun his notions out of air, or heard them from others who did so spin. This is perhaps the material which thy learned companion would hear, yet I would not mislead thee. It is in my mind..."
She looked to right and left as though unwilling to be overheard.
"That the old man is but a prater, though many listen willingly to him."
Trevise nodded.
Such prating is what we wish. Would it be possible for you to take my friend to this old man?
Mono Lee, he calls himself.
To Mono Lee, then. And do you think Mono Lee would be willing to speak to my friend?
He willing to speak,
said Hiroko scornfully.
Thou must ask, rather, if he be ever ready to cease from speaking. He is but a man, and will therefore speak, if allowed, till a fortnight hence, with no pause. I mean no offense, respected sir.
No offense taken. Would you lead my friend to Mono Lee now?
That may anyone do at any time. The ancient is ever home, and ever ready to greet an ear.
Trevise said, And perhaps an older woman would be willing to come and sit with Madame Bliss. She has the child to care for and cannot move about too much. It would please her to have company, for women, as you know, are fond of...
Prating?
Said Hiroko, clearly amused.
Why, so men say, although I have observed that men are always the greater babblers. Let the men return from their fishing, and one will vie with another in telling greater flights of fancy concerning their catches. None will mark them nor believe, but this will not stop them either. But enough of my prating, too. I will have a friend of my mother's, one whom I can see through the window, stay with Madame Bliss and the child. And before that, she will guide your friend, the respected doctor, to the aged Mono Lee. If your friend will hear as avidly as Mono Lee will prate, thou wilt scarcely part them in this life. Wilt thou pardon my absence a moment?
When she had left, Trevise turned to Pellerat and said, Listen, get what you can out of the old man. And Bliss, you find out what you can from whoever stays with you. What you want is anything about Earth.
And you, said Bliss, what will you do?
I will remain with Hiroko and try to find a third source. Bliss smiled.
Ah, yes. Pell will be with this old man, I with an old woman. You will force yourself to remain with this fetchingly unclad young woman. It seems a reasonable division of labor.
As it happens, Bliss, it is reasonable.
But you don't find it depressing that the reasonable division of labor should work out so, I suppose?
No, I don't. Why should I?
Why should you indeed?
Hiroko was back and sat down again.
It is all arranged. The respected Dr. Pellerat will be taken to Mono Lee, and the respected Madame Bliss, together with her child, will have company. May I be granted, then, respected Sir Trevise, the boon of further conversation with thee? Mayhap of this old earth of which thou...
Pratest? Asked Trevise.
Nay, said Hiroko, laughing. But thou dost well to mock me. I showed thee but discourtesy ere now in answering thy question on this matter. I would fain make amends.
Trevise turned to Pellerat. Fain? Be eager, said Pellerat softly. Trevise said, Miss Hiroko, I felt no discourtesy, but if it will make you feel better, I will gladly speak with you.
Kindly spoken, I thank thee, said Hiroko, rising.
Trevise rose too. Bliss, he said, make sure Janoff remains safe.
Leave that to me. As for you, you have your...
She nodded toward his holsters. I don't think I'll need them, said Trevise uncomfortably. He followed Hiroko out of the dining room. The sun was higher in the sky now, and the temperature was still warmer. There was an otherworldly smell, as always. Trevise remembered it had been faint on Camporeon,
a little musty on Aurora, and rather delightful on Solaria. On Melpomenia, they were in spacesuits where one is only aware of the smell of one's own body. In every case, it disappeared in a matter of hours as the osmic centers of the nose grew saturated. Here, on Alpha, the odor was a pleasant, grassy fragrance under the warming effect of the sun, and Treviz felt a bit annoyed, knowing that this, too, would soon disappear. They were approaching a small structure that seemed to be built of a pale pink plaster. "This," said Hiroko, "is my home. It used to belong to my mother's younger sister." She walked in and motioned Treviz to follow. The door was open, or, Treviz noticed as he passed through, it would be more accurate to say there was no door. Treviz said, "What do you do when it rains?" "We are ready. It will rain 2 days hence, for 3 hours ere dawn, when it is coolest, and when it will moisten the soil most powerfully. Then I have but to draw this curtain, both heavy and water-repellent, across the door." She did so as she spoke. It seemed made of a strong canvas-like material. "I will leave it in place now," she went on. "All will then know I am within, but not available, for I sleep or am occupied in matters of importance." "It doesn't seem much of a guardian of privacy." "Why should it not be? See, the entrance is covered." "But anyone could shove it aside." "With disregard of the wishes of the occupant?" Hiroko looked shocked. "Are such things done on thy world? It would be barbarous." Treviz grinned. "I only asked." She led him into the second of two rooms, and at her invitation he seated himself in a padded chair. There was something claustrophobic about the blockish smallness and emptiness of the rooms, but the house seemed designed for little more than seclusion and rest. The window openings were small and near the ceiling, but there were dull mirror strips in a careful pattern along the walls, which reflected light diffusely. There were slits in the floor from which a gentle, cool breeze uplifted. Treviz saw no signs of artificial lighting, and wondered if Alphonse had to wake at sunrise and go to bed at sunset. He was about to ask, but Hiroko spoke first, saying, "Is Madame Bliss thy woman companion?" Treviz said cautiously, "Do you mean by that, is she my sexual partner?" Hiroko colored. "I pray thee, have regard for the decencies of polite conversation, but I do mean private pleasantry." "No, she is the woman companion of my learned friend." "But thou art the younger and the more goodly." "Well, thank you for your opinion, but it is not Bliss's opinion. She likes Dr. Pellerat much more than she does me."
"That much surprises me. Will he not share?"
"I have not asked him whether he would, but I'm sure he wouldn't, nor would I want him to." Hiroko nodded her head wisely.
"I know. It is her fundament."
"Her fundament?"
"Thou knowest. This."
And she slapped her own dainty rear end.
"Oh, that. I understand you. Yes, Bliss is generously proportioned in her pelvic anatomy."
He made a curving gesture with his hands and winked, and Hiroko laughed. Treviz said, "Nevertheless, a great many men enjoy that kind of generosity of figure."
"I cannot believe so. Surely it would be a sort of gluttony to wish excess of that which is pleasant in moderation. Wouldst thou think more of me if my breasts were massive and dangling, with nipples pointing to toes? I have, in good sooth, seen such, yet have I not seen men flock to them. The poor women so afflicted must needs cover their monstrosities, as Madame Bliss does.
Such oversize wouldn't attract me either, though I am sure that Bliss doesn't cover her breasts for any imperfection they may have.
Thou dost not, then, disapprove of my visage or form?
I would be a madman to do so. You are beautiful.
And what dost thou for pleasantries on this ship of thine, as thou flittest from one world to the next, Madame Bliss being denied thee?
Nothing, Hiroko. There's nothing to do. I think of pleasantries on occasion, and that has its discomforts. But we who travel through space know well that there are times when we must do without. We make up for it at other times.
If it be a discomfort, how may that be removed?
I experience considerably more discomfort since you've brought up the subject. I don't think it would be polite to suggest how I might be comforted.
Would it be discourtesy were I to suggest a way?
It would depend entirely on the nature of the suggestion.
I would suggest that we be pleasant with each other.
Did you bring me here, Hiroko, that it might come to this? Hiroko said with a pleased smile.
Yes, it would be both my hostess' duty of courtesy, and it would be my wish, too.
If that's the case, I will admit it is my wish, too. In fact, I would like very much to oblige you in this. I would be fain to do thee pleasure.
Chapter 18, The Music Festival. 78. Lunch was in the same dining room in which they had had breakfast. It was full of Alphans, and with them were Trevise and Pellerat, made thoroughly welcome. Bliss and Phalum ate separately, and more or less privately, in a small annex. There were several varieties of fish, together with soup in which there were strips of what might well have been boiled kid. Loaves of bread were there for the slicing, butter and jam for the spreading. A salad, large and diffuse, came afterward, and there was a notable absence of any dessert, although fruit juices were passed about in apparently inexhaustible pitchers. Both foundationers were forced to be abstemious after their heavy breakfast, but everyone else seemed to eat freely.
"How do they keep from getting fat?" wondered Pellerat in a low voice.
Trevise shrugged. "Lots of physical labor, perhaps." It was clearly a society in which decorum at meals was not greatly valued. There was a miscellaneous hubbub of shouting, laughing, and thumping on the table with thick, obviously unbreakable cups. Women were as loud and raucous as men, albeit in higher pitch. Pellerat winced, but Trevise, who now, temporarily at least, felt no trace of the discomfort he had spoken of to Hiroko, felt both relaxed and good-natured. He said, "Actually, it has its pleasant side. These are people who appear to enjoy life and who have few, if any, cares. Weather is what they make it, and food is unimaginably plentiful. This is a golden age for them that simply continues and continues." He had to shout to make himself heard, and Pellerat shouted back, "But it's so noisy."
"They're used to it."
"I don't see how they can understand each other in this riot."
Certainly it was all lost on the two foundationers. The queer pronunciation and the archaic grammar and word order of the Alphan language made it impossible to understand at the intense sound levels. To the foundationers, it was like listening to the sounds of a zoo in fright. It was not till after lunch that they rejoined Bliss in a small structure which Trevise found to be rather inconsiderably different from Hiroko's quarters, and which had been assigned them as their own temporary living quarters. Phelim was in the second room, enormously relieved to be alone, according to Bliss, and attempting to nap. Pellerat looked at the door gap in the wall and said uncertainly, "There's very little privacy here. How can we speak freely?" "I assure you," said Trevise, "that once we pull the canvas barrier across the door, we won't be disturbed. The canvas makes it impenetrable by all the force of social custom." Pellerat glanced at the high open windows. "We can be overheard." "We need not shout. The Alphans won't eavesdrop. Even when they stood outside the windows of the dining room at breakfast, they remained at a respectful distance." Bliss smiled. "You've learned so much about Alphan customs in the time you spent alone with gentle little Hiroko, and you've gained such confidence in their respect for privacy. What happened?"
Trevise said, "If you're aware that the tendrils of my mind have undergone a change for the better and can guess the reason, I can only ask you to leave my mind alone."
"You know very well that Gaia will not touch your mind under any circumstances short of life crisis, and you know why. Still, I'm not mentally blind. I could sense what happened a kilometer away. Is this your invariable custom on space voyages, my erotomaniac friend?"
"Erotomaniac? Come, Bliss. Twice on this entire trip. Twice."
"We were only on two worlds that had functioning human females on them. Two out of two. And we had only been a few hours on each."
"You are well aware I had no choice on Camporeon."
"That makes sense. I remember what she looked like."
For a few moments, Bliss dissolved in laughter. Then she said,
"Yet I don't think Hiroko held you helpless in her mighty grip or inflicted her irresistible will on your cringing body."
"Of course not. I was perfectly willing. But it was her suggestion just the same." Pellerat said, with just a tinge of envy in his voice, "Does this happen to you all the time, Golan?"
"Of course it must, Pell," said Bliss. "Women are helplessly drawn to him."
"I wish that were so," said Trevise, "but it isn't. And I'm glad it isn't. I do have other things I want to do in life. Just the same, in this case I was irresistible. After all, we were the first people from another world that Hiroko had ever seen, or, apparently, that anyone now alive on Alpha had ever seen. I gathered from things she let slip, casual remarks, that she had the rather exciting notion that I might be different from Alphans, either anatomically or in my technique. Poor thing, I'm afraid she was disappointed."
"Oh," said Bliss. "Were you?"
"No," said Trevise. "I have been on a number of worlds, and I have had my experiences. And what I had discovered is that people are people, and sex is sex wherever one goes. If there are noticeable differences, they are usually both trivial and unpleasant. The perfumes I've encountered in my time. I remember when a young woman simply couldn't manage unless there was music loudly played, music that consisted of a desperate screeching sound. So she played the music, and then I couldn't manage. I assure you, if it's the same old thing, then I'm satisfied."
"Speaking of music," said Bliss, "we are invited to a musicale after dinner. A very formal thing, apparently, that is being held in our honor. I gather the Alphans are very proud of their music."
Trevise grimaced. "Their pride will in no way make the music sound better to our ears."
"Hear me out," said Bliss.
I gather that their pride is that they play expertly on very archaic instruments. Very archaic. We may get some information about Earth by way of them.
Trevise's eyebrows shot up. An interesting thought. And that reminds me that both of you may already have information. Janoff, did you see this Mona Lisa that Hiroko told us about?
Indeed I did, said Pellerat. I was with him for 3 hours, and Hiroko did not exaggerate. It was a virtual monologue on his part, and when I left to come to lunch, he clung to me and would not let me go until I promised to return whenever I could, in order that I might listen to him some more.
And did he say anything of interest?
Well, he too, like everybody else, insisted that Earth was thoroughly and murderously radioactive, that the ancestors of the Alphans were the last to leave, and that if they hadn't, they would have died. And Golan, he was so emphatic that I couldn't help believing him. I'm convinced that Earth is dead, and that our entire search is, after all, useless.
79. Trevise sat back in his chair, staring at Pellerat, who was sitting on a narrow cot. Bliss, having risen from where she had been sitting next to Pellerat, looked from one to the other. Finally, Trevise said, Let me be the judge as to whether our search is useless or not, Janoff. Tell me what the garrulous old man had to say to you. In brief, of course.
Pellerat said, I took notes as Mona Lisa spoke. It helped reinforce my role as scholar, but I don't have to refer to them. He was quite stream of consciousness in his speaking. Each thing he said would remind him of something else. But of course I have spent my life trying to organize information in the search of the relevant and significant, so that it's second nature for me now to be able to condense a long and incoherent discourse,
Trevise said gently, into something just as long and incoherent. To the point, dear Janoff.
Pellerat cleared his throat uneasily.
Yes, certainly, old chap. I'll try to make a connected and chronological tale out of it.
Earth was the original home of humanity and of millions of species of plants and animals. It continued so for countless years until hyperspatial travel was invented. Then the spacer worlds were founded. They broke away from Earth, developed their own cultures, and came to despise and oppress the mother planet. After a couple of centuries of this, Earth managed to regain its freedom, though Mona Lisa did not explain the exact manner in which this was done, and I dared not ask questions, even if he had given me a chance to interrupt, which he did not, for that might merely have sent him into new byways. He did mention a culture hero named Elijah Bailey, but the references were so characteristic of the habit of attributing to one figure the accomplishments of generations that there was little value in attempting to...
Bliss said,
Yes, Pell dear, we understand that part.
Again, Pellerat paused in midstream and reconsidered.
Of course, my apologies.
Earth initiated a second wave of settlements, founding many new worlds in a new fashion. The new group of settlers proved more vigorous than the spacers, outpaced them, defeated them, outlasted them, and eventually established the Galactic Empire. During the course of the wars between the settlers and the spacers, no, not wars, for he used the word conflict, being very careful about that, the Earth became radioactive.
Trevise said with clear annoyance, That's ridiculous, Janoff. How can a world become radioactive?
Every world is very slightly radioactive to one degree or another from the moment of formation, and that radioactivity slowly decays. It doesn't become radioactive.
Pellerat shrugged. I'm only telling you what he said, and he was only telling me what he had heard, from someone who only told him what he had heard, and so on. It's folk history, told and retold over the generations, with who knows what distortions creeping in at each retelling.
I understand that. But are there no books, documents, ancient histories which have frozen the story at an early time and which could give us something more accurate than the present tale?
Actually, I managed to ask that question, and the answer is no. He said vaguely that there were books about it in ancient times, and that they had long ago been lost, but that what he was telling us was what had been in those books.
Yes, well distorted. It's the same story. In every world we go to, the records of Earth have, in one way or another, disappeared.
Well, how did he say the radioactivity began on Earth?
He didn't in any detail. The closest he came to saying so was that the spacers were responsible. But then I gathered that the spacers were the demons on whom the people of Earth blamed all misfortune. The radioactivity...
A clear voice overrode him here.
Bliss, am I a spacer?
Phelim was standing in the narrow doorway between the two rooms, hair tousled, and the nightgown she was wearing, designed to fit Bliss's more ample proportions, having slid off one shoulder to reveal an undeveloped breast.
Bliss said, "We worry about eavesdropping outside, and we forget the one inside."
"Now, Phelim, why do you say that?"
She rose and walked toward the youngster. Phelim said,
"I don't have what they have."
She pointed at the two men.
"Or what you have, Bliss. I'm different. Is that because I'm a spacer?"
"You are, Phelim," said Bliss soothingly.
"But little differences don't matter. Come back to bed."
"You are, Phelim," said Bliss soothingly. "But little differences don't matter. Come back to bed." Phelim became submissive, as she always did when Bliss willed her to be so. She turned and said,
"Am I a demon? What is a demon?"
Bliss said over her shoulder, "Wait one moment for me. I'll be right back." She was within 5 minutes. She was shaking her head.
"She'll be sleeping now till I wake her. I should have done that before, I suppose, but any modification of the mind must be the result of necessity."
She added defensively,
"I can't have her brood on the differences between her genital equipment and ours."
Pellerat said, "Someday she'll have to know she's hermaphroditic."
"Someday," said Bliss, "but not now. Go on with the story, Pell."
"Yes," said Trevise, "before something else interrupts us." "Well, Earth became radioactive, or at least its crust did. At that time, Earth had had an enormous population that was centered in huge cities that existed for the most part underground."
"Now that," put in Trevise, "is surely not so. It must be local patriotism glorifying the golden age of a planet, and the details were simply a distortion of Trantor in its golden age, when it was the imperial capital of a galaxy-wide system of worlds."
Pellerat paused, then said, "Really, Golan, you mustn't teach me my business. We mythologists know very well that myths and legends contain borrowings, moral lessons, nature cycles, and 100 other distorting influences, and we labor to cut them away and get to what might be a kernel of truth. In fact, these same techniques must be applied to the most sober histories, for no one writes the clear and apparent truth, if such a thing can even be said to exist. For now, I'm telling you more or less what Mona Lee told me, though I suppose I am adding distortions of my own, try as I might not to do so.
Well, well, said Trevise. Go on, Janoff, I meant no offense.
And I've taken none. The huge cities, assuming they existed, crumbled and shrank as the radioactivity slowly grew more intense, until the population was but a remnant of what it had been, clinging precariously to regions that were relatively radiation-free. The population was kept down by rigid birth control and by the euthanasia of people over 60.
Horrible, said Bliss indignantly.
Undoubtedly, said Pellerat. But that is what they did, according to Mona Lee, and that might be true, for it is certainly not complimentary to the Earth people, and it is not likely that an uncomplimentary lie would be made up. The Earth people, having been despised and oppressed by the Spacers, were now despised and oppressed by the Empire, though here we may have exaggeration there out of self-pity, which is a very seductive emotion. There is the case...
Yes, yes, Pellerat, another time. Please go on with Earth.
I beg your pardon. The Empire, in a fit of benevolence, agreed to substitute imported radiation-free soil and to cart away the contaminated soil. Needless to say, that was an enormous task which the Empire soon tired of, especially as this period, if my guess is right, coincided with the fall of Kandar V, after which the Empire had many more things to worry about than Earth. The radioactivity continued to grow more intense, the population continued to fall, and finally the Empire, in another fit of benevolence, offered to transplant the remnant of the population to a new world of their own, to this world, in short. At an earlier period, it seems an expedition had stocked the ocean, so that by the time the plans for the transplantation of Earth people were being developed, there was a full oxygen atmosphere and an ample supply of food on Alpha. Nor did any of the worlds of the Galactic Empire covet this world, because there is a certain natural antipathy to planets that circle stars of a binary system. There are so few suitable planets in such a system, I suppose, that even suitable ones are rejected because of the assumption that there must be something wrong with them. This is a common thought fashion. There is the well-known case, for instance, of...
Later with the well-known case, Janoff, said Trevise. On with the transplantation.
What remained, said Pellerat, hurrying his words a little, was to prepare a land base. The shallowest part of the ocean was found, and sediment was raised from deeper parts to add to the shallow sea bottom, and finally to produce the island of New Earth. Boulders and coral were dredged up and added to the island. Land plants were seeded so that root systems might help make the new land firm. Again, the Empire had set itself an enormous task. Perhaps continents were planned at first, but by the time this one island was produced, the Empire's moment of benevolence had passed. What was left of Earth's population was brought here. The Empire's fleets carried off its men and machinery, and they never returned. The Earth people, living on New Earth, found themselves in complete isolation. Trevise said, complete? Did Mona Lee say that no one from elsewhere in the galaxy has ever come here till we did?
Almost complete, said Pellerat. There is nothing to come here for, I suppose, even if we set aside the superstitious distaste for binary systems. Occasionally, at long intervals, a ship would come, as ours did. But it would eventually leave, and there has never been a follow-up. And that's it.
Trevise said, Did you ask Mona Lee where Earth was located?
Of course I asked that. He didn't know.
How can he know so much about Earth's history without knowing where it is located?
I asked him specifically, Golan, if the star that was only a parsec or so distant from Alpha might be the sun about which Earth revolved. He didn't know what a parsec was, and I said it was a short distance, astronomically speaking. He said, short or long, he did not know where Earth was located, and he didn't know anyone who knew. And in his opinion, it was wrong to try to find it. It should be allowed, he said, to move endlessly through space in peace.
Trevise said, Do you agree with him?
Pellerat shook his head sorrowfully. Not really. But he said that at the rate the radioactivity continued to increase, the planet must have become totally uninhabitable not long after the transplantation took place, and that by now it must be burning intensely so that no one can approach.
Nonsense, said Trevise firmly. A planet cannot become radioactive, and having done so, continuously increase in radioactivity. Radioactivity can only decrease.
But Mona Lee is so sure of it. So many people we've talked to on various worlds unite in this, that Earth is radioactive. Surely it is useless to go on.
80. Trevise drew a deep breath, then said in a carefully controlled voice, Nonsense, Genoff. That's not true.
Pellerat said, Well now, old chap, you mustn't believe something just because you want to believe it.
My wants have nothing to do with it. In world after world, we find all records of Earth wiped out. Why should they be wiped out if there is nothing to hide? If Earth is a dead, radioactive world that cannot be approached.
I don't know, Golan.
Yes, you do. When we were approaching Melpomenia, you said that the radioactivity might be the other side of the coin. Destroy records to remove accurate information. Supply the tail of radioactivity to insert inaccurate information. Both would discourage any attempt to find Earth, and we mustn't be deluded into discouragement.
Bliss said, Actually, you seem to think the nearby star is Earth's sun. Why then continue to argue the question of radioactivity? What does it matter? Why not simply go to the nearby star and see if it is Earth, and, if so, what it is like?
Trevise said, Because those on Earth must be in their way extraordinarily powerful, and I would prefer to approach with some knowledge of the world and its inhabitants. As it is, since I continue to remain ignorant of Earth, approaching it is dangerous. It is my notion that I leave the rest of you here on Alpha and that I proceed to Earth by myself. One life is quite enough to risk.
No, Golan, said Pellerat earnestly. Bliss and the child might wait here, but I must go with you. I have been searching for Earth since before you were born, and I cannot stay behind when the goal is so close, whatever dangers might threaten.
Bliss and the child will not wait here, said Bliss. I am Gaia, and Gaia can protect us even against Earth.
I hope you're right, said Trevise gloomily. But Gaia could not prevent the elimination of all early memories of Earth's role in its founding.
That was done in Gaia's early history, when it was not yet well organized, not yet advanced. Matters are different now.
I hope that is so. Or is it that you have gained information about Earth this morning that we don't have? I did ask that you speak to some of the older women that might be available here.
And so I did.
Trevise said, And what did you find out?
Nothing about Earth. There is a total blank there. But they are advanced biotechnologists.
Oh?
On this small island, they have grown and tested innumerable strains of plants and animals, and designed a suitable ecological balance, stable and self-supporting, despite the few species with which they began. They have improved on the ocean life that they found when they arrived here a few thousand years ago, increasing their nutritive value and improving their taste. It is their biotechnology that has made this world such a cornucopia of plenty. They have plans for themselves, too.
What kind of plans?
Bliss said. They know perfectly well they cannot reasonably expect to expand their range under present circumstances, confined as they are to the one small patch of land that exists on their world. But they dream of becoming amphibious.
Of becoming what?
Amphibious. They plan to develop gills in addition to lungs. They dream of being able to spend substantial periods of time underwater, of finding shallow regions and building structures on the ocean bottom. My informant was quite glowing about it, but she admitted that this had been a goal of the Alphans for some centuries now, and that little, if any, progress had been made.
Trevise said, That's two fields in which they might be more advanced than we are, weather control and biotechnology.
I wonder what their techniques are.
We'd have to find specialists, said Bliss, and they might not be willing to talk about it.
Trevise said, It's not our primary concern here, but it would clearly pay the Foundation to attempt to learn from this miniature world.
Pellerat said, We manage to control the weather fairly well on Terminus as it is.
Control is good on many worlds, said Trevise. But always, it's a matter of the world as a whole. Here, the Alphans control the weather of a small portion of the world, and they must have techniques we don't have.
Anything else, Bliss?
Social invitations. These appear to be a holiday-making people, in whatever time they can take from farming and fishing. After dinner tonight, there'll be a music festival. I told you about that already. Tomorrow, during the day, there will be a beach festival. Apparently, all around the rim of the island, there will be a congregation of everyone who can get away from the fields in order that they might enjoy the water and celebrate the sun, since it will be raining the next day. In the morning, the fishing fleet will come back, beating the rain, and by evening there will be a food festival, sampling the catch.
Pellerat groaned, The meals are ample enough as it is. What would a food festival be like?
I gather that it will feature not quantity, but variety. In any case, all four of us are invited to participate in all the festivals, especially the music festival tonight.
On the antique instruments? Asked Trevise.
That's right.
What makes them antique, by the way? Primitive computers?
No, that's the point. It isn't electronic music at all, but mechanical. They described it to me. They scrape strings, blow in tubes, and bang on surfaces.
I hope you're making that up, said Trevise, appalled.
No, I'm not. And I understand that your Hiroko will be blowing on one of the tubes. I forget its name. And you ought to be able to endure that.
As for myself, said Pellerat, I would love to go. I know very little about primitive music, and I would like to hear it.
She is not my Hiroko, said Trevise coldly. But are the instruments of the type once used on Earth, do you suppose?
So I gathered, said Bliss.
At least the Alphan women said they were designed long before their ancestors came here.
In that case, said Trevise, it may be worth listening to all that scraping, tootling, and banging for whatever information it might conceivably yield concerning Earth.
81. Oddly enough, it was Phelim who was most excited at the prospect of a musical evening. She and Bliss had bathed in the small outhouse behind their quarters. It had a bath with running water, hot and cold, or rather warm and cool, a washbowl and a commode. It was totally clean and usable, and in the late afternoon sun, it was even well-lit and cheerful. As always, Phelim was fascinated with Bliss's breasts, and Bliss was reduced to saying, now that Phelim understood Galactic, that on her world, that was the way people were. To which Phelim said inevitably, why? And Bliss, after some thought, decided there was no sensible way of answering, returned the universal reply, because. When they were done, Bliss helped Phelim put on the undergarments supplied them by the Alphans and worked out the system whereby the skirt went on over it. Leaving Phelim unclothed from the waist up seemed reasonable enough. She herself, while making use of Alphan garments below the waist, rather tight about the hips, put on her own blouse. It seemed silly to be too inhibited to expose breasts in a society where all women did, especially since her own were not large and were as shapely as any she had seen. But there it was. The two men took their turn at the outhouse next, Trevise muttering the usual male complaint concerning the time the women had taken. Bliss turned Phelim about to make sure the skirt would hold in place over her boyish hips and buttocks. She said, It's a very pretty skirt, Phelim. Do you like it? Phelim stared at it in a mirror and said, Yes, I do. Won't I be cold with nothing on, though? And she ran her hands down her bare chest. I don't think so, Phelim. It's quite warm on this world. You have something on? Yes, I do. That's how it is on my world. Now, Phelim, we're going to be with a great many Alphans during dinner and afterward. Do you think you can bear that?
Phelim looked distressed, and Bliss went on.
I will sit on your right side, and I will hold you. Pell will sit on the other side, and Trevise will sit across the table from you. We won't let anyone talk to you, and you won't have to talk to anyone. I'll try, Bliss,
Phelim piped in her highest tones.
Then afterward, said Bliss, some Alphans will make music for us in their own special way. Do you know what music is?
She hummed in the best imitation of electronic harmony that she could.
Phelim's face lit up. You mean?
The last word was in her own language, and she burst into song. Bliss's eyes widened. It was a beautiful tune, even though it was wild and rich in trills.
That's right. Music, she said.
Phelim said excitedly,
Djembe made.
She hesitated, then decided to use the galactic word.
Music all the time. It made music on a...
Again a word in her own language. Bliss repeated the word doubtfully.
On a feeful?
Phelim laughed.
Not feeful.
With both words juxtaposed like that, Bliss could hear the difference, but she despaired of reproducing the second. She said,
What does it look like?
Phalum's as yet limited vocabulary in Galactic did not suffice for an accurate description, and her gestures did not produce any shape clearly in Bliss's mind.
"He showed me how to use the..."
Phalum said proudly.
"I used my fingers just the way Jemby did."